Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickard is out today. Coming up, a new bipartisan assembly task force is taking on the issue of youth workforce readiness here in Wisconsin. We'll talk to the chair of that committee about how he plans to tackle the issue. First, in the coming year, Wisconsin's lakes will be a testing ground for documenting and predicting how organisms respond to climate change and pollutants. Does lake life evolve and continue to survive as its habitat changes, or is it likely to die out? That's a key question that our next guest will be tackling as he studies 20 lakes throughout Wisconsin and Alaska. Matthew Walsh is assistant professor of biology at the University of Texas at Arlington. He was awarded a grant from the National Science Foundation announced last week. He joins us now to talk about the work he's going to be doing. Matthew, thanks a lot for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So big question here, but as of right now, what do we know about how organisms evolve in the wild in the face of climate change and human-made pollutants?
Well, it's a really key question because in order for organisms to persist, one possibility is that they could evolve over time. And at the current juncture in time, it's really unclear whether or not organisms will exhibit the capacity to keep pace with ongoing climate change.
Well, let's jump in the lakes you're going to study now. Why, first of all, why lakes? Why Wisconsin lakes in particular?
Well, the reason we're focusing on this particular set of lakes in Wisconsin and also Alaska is because scientists have been studying these lakes for approximately 30 years. And over this period of time, they've documented extensive ecological changes in response to several common anthropogenic forces, such as ongoing climate change. And, you know, from my perspective, this framework of long-term ecological change is really great because we've also become to understand that evolution can occur very rapidly in a natural setting. And so then what I can then do is use this existing framework to then ask fundamental questions regarding how evolution proceeds in a natural setting, how predictable it is, but also why it might also be important to the ecology of these systems.
And who are you going to be looking at in particular in the lakes? What kind of critters are we talking about here?
I mean, so the main focus of the grant is looking at zooplankton. So the things that eat the primary producers and the things that also are an important food item for things like small fish.
And how important are these as part of the basis for the rest of the food chain, the ecosystem they're part of?
Well, they're really a kind of key leverage point because they exert quite a bit of control over the amount of primary producers that are apparent in these systems, and thus they'll have an influence on primary production, on water clarity, overall water quality. But then they're also going to be a main food source for fish, and it'll determine all the health of that trophic level as well. And so then if these things are evolving, then they may have cascading or correlated impacts that transcend just their point in the food chain.
We're talking to biologist Matthew Walsh from the University of Texas at Arlington. He's kicking off a study of Wisconsin lakes and Alaska lakes, looking at the impact of human changes, things like climate change, pollution, on evolution, on lake species. So, Matthew, do you know yet, have you selected the lakes you're going to work on here in Wisconsin? Where are you going?
So the lakes that have been studied are found in two different parts of the state. There's a series of four lakes in the southern part of the state down near Madison, and there's also a series of seven lakes in the more northern part of the state. And both areas have experienced different types of changes, in addition to things like ongoing climate change, but also lots of changes in terms of human development.
And it sounds like, in a way, this is a race. Can a species evolve fast enough to adapt to these rapidly changing conditions before it dies off completely?
I mean, that's one possibility. I mean, organisms exhibit the capacity to alter their traits without evolving, but in the long run, evolution may be an important contributor to the extent to which that organisms are able to persist in environments, depending upon how extreme the environmental change is.
And when we look at something like these plankton, the zooplankton, what kind of changes have we observed maybe elsewhere in previous research? What kind of changes evolutionarily are they capable of making over time to keep up?
Well, I mean, what scientists have shown in the past, at least one particular type of change that's important, at least to the ecology of lakes, is that zooplankton, if you change the type of predators they experience, they'll evolve changes in how rapidly they grow, how many offspring they produce, and how large they are. And if zooplankton then exhibit changes in something like body size, then that may influence then the type of algae they eat. And so then you could see how evolution then may lead to some cascading impact that will influence then, say, primary production in lakes.
And what human-made changes are you focusing on in particular in these Wisconsin and Alaska lakes? We've mentioned climate change. What types of pollution and other human-made changes are you looking at here?
In terms of human development, the main source of change would be at least changes in nutrient inputs associated with eutrophication. So the amount of nitrogen and phosphorus that often accompany human development on lakeside, and how changes in the amount of phosphorus and how that might then influence the phenotypes of zooplankton in these lakes.
And then we hear about these issues a lot here, especially the phosphorus and nitrogen pollutants. How big a game changer are those pollutants in a lake ecosystem?
I mean, it could dramatically alter the food chain kind of across trophic levels, because if you alter the nutrient inputs, you're going to alter then the amount and the types of phytoplankton that are in these systems, and then that's going to influence, it's going to go up the food chain, it's going to influence then the zooplankton in terms of what type of phytoplankton they're exposed to, which ones they can or cannot eat, and then if you alter then the zooplankton populations, it's going to propagate up the food chain up to the fish.
So on a practical level, how are you going to conduct this research?
I mean, there's really two main components. On the one hand, and initially, what we're doing is leveraging all of the extensive knowledge that's already out there for these systems. These lakes have been intensively sampled for, in some cases, decades, over the course of the whole year, sometimes biweekly over the course of the whole year. And so what we're going to do is use all of this existing data on ecological change and simply ask, is there a signal for evolution in all that data? Or are the zooplankton changing over time? And maybe what is best predicting these phenotypic changes?
Yeah, as I understand it, at least in some of the lakes around Madison, the UW's limnology department has had buoys out there collecting samples for, as you say, decades. Is this a rarity among lakes? Are there lakes generally this intensively studied?
I think that the systems I'm studying in Wisconsin and in probably Alaska might be the most extensive amount of data we have on lakes in North America. And so it is unique, and that's really the unique aspect of this grant, is that we have all this data available, we can ask whether or not evolution might be occurring, and then we could also go and perform experiments and confirm and identify why evolution has occurred.
So what's the timeline for this work you're doing now?
The work will be conducted over the course of 2 years, and initially, again, as we're using existing data, and then beginning in the spring, we'll actually go and visit these lakes and begin to collect organisms and then perform experiments in the lab.
So when you come out with some results here, what kind of things will we learn from this that we can apply elsewhere in the world of biology and maybe to maintaining lake habitats?
Well, at a really fundamental level, what I'm asking questions about is, how predictable is evolution in response to these anthropogenic changes? Do you see consistent changes in the traits of zooplankton, both within a number of lakes in Wisconsin, but also across very distinct ecosystems between Wisconsin and Alaska? So if you see very, very common anthropogenic changes occurring, then do you see the same evolutionary changes occurring? And the reason that that's important more broadly is because it may tell us then something about the capacity of organisms to evolve in response to ongoing climate change, whether they're able to persist in the face of any kind of anthropogenic changes. And then more generally, it might lead us, it might give us a better capability of predicting what the consequences of climate change or eutrophication might be over time.
Well, it might be interesting to see, too, if, two lakes experiencing similar conditions, say more, as you mentioned, phosphorus and nitrogen, might the same zooplankton develop one response in this lake and a different response in that other lake?
Yeah, that's certainly possible, and that's one of the main reasons that we're conducting this work, is to see whether or not the changes are consistent. And if they're not consistent, then we have to figure out why.
Is this a new kind of research? You mentioned that there had been previous research on, maybe a reacting to a different predator or larger predators. Has there been a lot of work on evolution in response to human changes?
I mean, there's certainly people have, this is absolutely not the first study to look at the human consequences or the evolutionary consequences of human activities. I think the unique aspect is that it's embedded in a really unique data set or study system where scientists have been documenting the changes for 30 years. And so we don't have to infer evolution by comparing, say, organisms found in different environments. we can go and look at all of the data that exists and ask whether or not we're seeing consistent changes in the plankton over time, as it occurred more or less in real time over the past several decades.
Well, maybe we will see you out on the water next spring. Matthew, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right, thanks for having me.
That's Matthew Walsh. He's an assistant professor of biology at the University of Texas at Arlington. He was awarded a National Science Foundation grant announced just last week to study how organisms in 20 lakes in Wisconsin and Alaska respond to things like climate change and pollution. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss created three bipartisan task forces in August to address issues important to the state of Wisconsin. One of those will focus on issues of youth workforce readiness. On this Labor Day, we'll meet the chair of that new task force. Representative Bob Culp is a Republican who represents the 69th Assembly District, which includes Stratford. He's the chair of the Speaker's Task Force on Youth Workforce Readiness. Representative Culp, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's excellent to be with you, Rob, and all of your listeners, and I look forward to a great interview.
Well, that puts me on the spot. I will try. So why a task force? Why this particular issue, youth workforce readiness?
Well, you know, I think it's no secret there are more people are leaving the workforce than are getting in these days just because of the demographics that we have. And, of course, we can't fix that. But what we want to do is try to put the youth, especially youth, but really everyone, but into the best shape possible to enter into the workforce, primarily into technical jobs, technical careers, construction. I think one of the issues that we're going to be doing is looking at ways that we can re-message or maybe remarket the concept of these jobs as family-supporting, because they truly are. They're not dark, dirty, and dead end anymore. So again, it's a demographics issue, and we want to make that youth workforce as ready as possible to get into engaging into the workforce.
As you mentioned, this is seen in part as a publicity issue. Maybe there are a lot of people in high school, say, who these jobs are not even crossing their minds as possible career futures. Is that part of the problem you're seeing?
That certainly is. And what there has been a lot of efforts, there have been a lot of successful efforts with companies that are working with schools and investing into those schools. Historically, I guess, if you look at it, education and industry has kind of been on parallel tracks, and they've kind of been heading in the same direction, but they've been far apart, and once in a while they would yell across the void or the chasm or, you know, smoke signals or something. But I think that is changing, and that's what we want to continue to do, try to reduce the barriers that are out there, not only with regards to industry and education, but also with regards to dual enrollment programs with high schools and tech colleges. A lot has already been done, but we're just looking at kind of figuring out where the problems still lie, as well as looking at what's been successful, because there have been a lot of things that have been successful.
Well, let's start on the employer side now. Are we hearing from employers saying, hey, we've got these good-paying skilled manufacturing jobs or these craft person-type jobs, technical trades? We don't have the young applicants getting into these jobs.
Without question. I outside of the state representative responsibilities, I own a roofing company, and I hear all the time from every industry, manufacturing, construction, there are lots and lots of jobs available, and somehow we need to, as an industry, do a better job of reaching into the schools and just giving the kids the idea that, hey, this is a good place to go. So absolutely, the jobs are there without question.
Well, now let's visit, say, the high school level. What kind of ideas are you looking to get in this task force to help the right students start this kind of training?
Sure. Youth are the guidance counselors in school districts have their plates full. They are, jam-packed. They're going a mile a minute and faster, and trying to get them to tell kids about these jobs that are out there might be a little bit of a reach, but there are some pilot programs in different parts of the states where people have come in and talked to the kids directly. Job fairs are something that people have done, but we want to do something, I think, at least look at doing something that is more possibly systematic and reward school districts. There are already some things in place that reward school districts for getting kids into the tech trades and in construction. So again, we have our first meeting coming up on Thursday. Looking forward to that. It's going to be jammed with testimony. It's going to be a very long day, but there are a lot of people that just really have come out of the woodwork saying, we're doing this, it works, we need this, and we'd like to talk about it. So Thursday will be a great day for getting a lot of those ideas solidified.
Yeah, you mentioned success stories. What kind of specific programs are out there? Maybe the people who are going to talk to you on Thursday who are saying, we're trying something that seems to be doing the job.
And that's really where we're at. You know, at this point, we don't have, we've heard whispers about what is working, and we're looking forward to sitting down with the folks that have made these things happen in small ways and look at expanding them. So, again, by Thursday, I'll know a lot more. And then, of course, we're going to be looking at taking the show on the road, if you will, likely doing a session in the southeastern Wisconsin area and the Fox Valley, and one in central Wisconsin coming up later this month. We're partnering with the tech colleges to host these as we move outside of the Capitol.
I'm talking to Assembly Representative Bob Culp. He is chair of the new Speakers Task Force on Youth Workforce Readiness. They're working to bring some ideas to the table to figure out how to get more young people into training and into skilled manufacturing and technical jobs. They kick off later this week with a meeting. Now, Representative Culp, who is going to be at the table? Who are you going to be hearing from at this meeting when you start things off on Thursday?
Oh, there are school districts, there are tech colleges, I could name the list, but this is just a small sliver of what's going to happen throughout the state. We're going to be talking to people with the developmentally disabled and some programs they've been working on. We have about 12 or 15 people or entities that have asked to testify at our first meeting on Thursday.
Now, we hear sometimes about a brain drain problem here in Wisconsin, where even if we do train someone, get them through technical school or college, there's some chance that they're going to leave, go to Twin Cities, Chicago, or a coast or something. Do you think that's something that needs to be at the table in this task force to not only train people, but keep them here in Wisconsin for those
jobs?
Well,
I think it certainly is a valid point. And, you know, obviously, if you have a brain drain, probably half of the states have a brain drain and half of them have a brain increase. And we happen to be one of them that one of the states that is highly manufacturing for we really have more manufacturing jobs per capita than anyone else, and of course that's that lends to that equation. But we don't have any. We do have some parameters and a scope that we're looking at, but we'll certainly listen to people give us ideas as to how to stem that tide.
Now, sometimes when we hear talk about a skills gap, the idea that we have skilled jobs and not the skilled workers going for them, some people say, hey, let the market correct for this. The companies can pay more. They can offer, they can train in their own people as needed. Do we really need a coordinated effort to get schools and tech colleges to solve that problem?
I think we do. Obviously, it's partly about pay, but, you know, for the most part, manufacturing jobs are starting in the mid-teens for starting without any experience and, you know, mid-teens per hour, and they can really go up to, you know, $30, $40 an hour. So these are family-supporting jobs. I don't know that it's necessarily, certainly the market will correct it over time, but it is something that I believe needs a concerted look from all of the angles, and that's what we're doing.
Oh, we'll bring in a caller. Rana calls in from Clayton. Rana, hi.
Hi. Good afternoon, and good afternoon to your guest. I'm an ag education teacher in a small community in northwest Wisconsin. Under my ag umbrella, I teach at welding and some light building construction, and I have employers coming to me all the time looking for somewhat skilled, in the areas that I teach anyway, high school students that can fill this huge employability gap that we have with the skilled trades. And I'm very pleased to see that this task force has been developed. And I'm wondering if there's a place on the web I can watch its progression.
There certainly is. I don't have the website right in front of me. I wasn't prepared for that question, frankly. But what I can do is I can provide it to Wisconsin Public Radio, and they can potentially post it or get it out there somewhere. So, but if you would Google Speakers task force on youth readiness, youth workforce readiness, I would guess something would come up as well.
And Ronna, watch the Central Time Facebook page. We'll find that and get a link there for you.
Now, wonderful. Isn't technology great?
It is. Ronna, thanks for that call. So when we think legislature and Wisconsin Representative Culp, contention, disagreement, partisan divide leap to mind. Is this the kind of issue, though, that you think both parties can find common ground on and work together to get some things done?
Well, the task force is designed to be bipartisan. In fact, Representative Katrina Shanklin from the Stevens Point area is the co-chair. And, you know, I think that it certainly is. What we have done altogether too often, I suppose, is thrown stones at each other rather than really look at building something with those stones. And I think this is a case where we can do that and remove the barriers, increase the collaboration, look at studying the creative models that have been effective and working, and really just, you know, there's a lot that workforce development has already done and we're delighted about. So we're just looking at filling in those edges and getting the messaging out throughout the state.
And briefly, as we wrap up, do you have a timeline for when you want to give recommendations to the whole legislature on this?
The final meeting of the task force, we're intending 4 or 5. We haven't fully decided yet. We'll see as it rolls out. But the last one meeting will be after the first of the year. So it will likely be sometime in February is when we'll be making those recommendations and doing that.
Representative Culp, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks a lot. My pleasure.
That's State Assembly Representative Bob Culp from Stratford in Marathon County. He's the newly appointed chair of the Speaker's Task Force on Youth Workforce Readiness. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. The study and treatment of autism in America has a long and complicated history. Until recently, many assumed it was a very rare condition. However, after changes to the definition in mid-1990s, we've seen an explosion in the population of people who have been diagnosed with symptoms of autism. Just a few years ago, some were calling it an epidemic. Our next guest has been looking into autism, talking to people living with it, their family members, researchers. He says we may need to fundamentally rethink our understanding of autism. Steve Silberman joins us now to talk about his New York Times bestselling book, Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity. Steve, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. It's a privilege to be here.
Well, some common thinking about autism is that it's something new. It's emerged all of a sudden as an epidemic. You say in your research, no, not really. Why is that?
That's the thing. I completely understand why parents are very frightened by sort of the constant stream of news stories talking about an autism epidemic and attributing it to everything from pesticides to living near freeways to Wi-Fi, et cetera. And as someone who's been writing about autism as a science writer for really over about 15 years, I started to become concerned that almost all of the social discussion about autism that was happening really all over the world was focused on sort of this week's cause du jour. You know, obviously we all know that there were huge arguments about vaccines that are still going on, actually. And, you know, every science story that comes along really tends to attribute the growth in diagnoses to this or that alleged cause in the environment. However, I knew that some of the old-time researchers in autism understood that what had really changed the most about autism was its definition. That back in the 1970s, when autism was indeed very, very rarely diagnosed, in fact, only 3.5 children in 10,000 were estimated as having autism back then, to now, when the CDC estimates that it's 1 in 68 American school children, that the framework of autism had completely changed, and the diagnosis had become much more inclusive and expansive. For instance, now it's very common to say that so-and-so is on the spectrum or so-and-so has a child on the spectrum. Well, back in the 1970s, there was no spectrum. Autism was understood as this very narrowly defined, exceptionally rare form of childhood psychosis. Most psychiatrists in America blamed autism on bad parenting, and it was a really terrible time for families because in addition to struggling with the very real daily needs of raising an autistic child, they had to deal with this burden of guilt and shame by being blamed for their children's autism. And in fact, the recommended treatment for autism back then was institutionalization. So two generations of autistic kids born in the 50s and the 70s were put in institutions, and that made them invisible to the larger society. So something that people say to me often is, well, where were all the autistic people when I was growing up? I never saw them. Well, the autistic people who were profoundly disabled were in institutions, and the autistic people who were, you know, what we would now call geeky or eccentric or whatever, did not have a diagnosis and were just sort of struggling to get by without any word that helped explain why they were struggling.
And you write that the focus on, well, the supposed explosion of autism and what you were just talking about, the idea that we need to find the modern day cause, distracts from maybe an important issue, and that's adaptation. How does someone with autism, profound, mild, otherwise, get along in daily life here in the United States? How can we help them do that?
That's exactly true. And, you know, for the last 10 years or so, we have spent over $1 billion on autism research. And, you know, we tend to think that that means that as a society, we're taking autism very seriously. Well, where is that money going? That money is going into finding more candidate genes for autism, genes that might contribute to the condition, or finding more alleged environmental triggers. And, you know, that's very interesting science. I'm a science writer. I love science. Many of my friends work in autism science. It's certainly, a fascinating pursuit. But here's the problem. At the same time that all this science is going on, families of autistic children and autistic people themselves are being hung out to dry. Because when kids graduate from high school, they are what autism parents call age out of services. So basically, there are very, very few services, and none in many areas of the country, available to help kids who can work and who want desperately to somehow contribute to their society, to help them learn the things that they need to know how to do that will help them get jobs. And not only that, there are many issues around autism that are still relatively under-researched. For instance, what is autism in women? Is it very different than what autism is in men? Historically, four times as many boys as girls have been diagnosed with autism. I think that it's possible that it's because autism expresses itself very differently in women, and we still know very little about that. Unbelievably, we know so little about the lives of autistic adults. And believe it or not, a government report came out in June that showed that the amount of research into improving the lives of autistic adults has actually fallen in recent years, which is beyond belief. We don't even know how many autistic adults are out there struggling to get by without a diagnosis in the community. So one of the main points of my book is that if we want to really take autism seriously, we have to start taking care of the people who are here already and their families who are really suffering and really, left out in the cold.
We're talking to Steve Silberman about his new book, Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity. And Steve, another main point of your book seems to be we need to change the way we think about autism. And this is coming, it sounds like, from researchers, from people with autism themselves, not necessarily as a disease condition or a mental health disorder. Maybe it's a handicap, or maybe it's just part of a natural spectrum of, as you say in your title, neurodiversity. Can you talk about what changing that mindset would mean?
Sure. Well, probably the word neurodiversity has become sort of controversial. Probably the quickest explanation for it that I can come up with is great minds don't necessarily think alike. Many of the aspects of science and culture and technology that we take for granted have been invented by people with autistic traits or people with dyslexia or people with ADHD or bipolar. And so what we have to start thinking about is a range of varieties of human cognition, or different ways to think, different kinds of minds, as the autistic writer Temple Grandin puts it. She herself is one of the leading industrial designers in the field of raising livestock, and she has talked about in her books about how the eccentricities of her brain and the ways that she thinks that are typical to autism have really helped her work. And so there's a huge population of people who are eager to make contributions to our society, but because we focus so exclusively on children rather than autistic adults, and because we focus so exclusively on uncovering the cause, I mean, we've been searching for the cause of schizophrenia, you know, for decades, and we haven't found it. For a long time, we were searching for the cause of homosexuality, and we didn't find it. These are very, very complex genetic conditions. And so we can keep doing that for another decade and another $1 billion, or we can start offering autistic people and their families the help they desperately need.
And the idea here for the benefit to people who don't have autism is, hey, maybe this is a missed opportunity. Maybe there are a lot of minds out there that could solve some of our problems that we'll never know if we don't figure out a way to connect our society to the way they think.
That's exactly right. And, you know, in a rainforest, biodiversity is considered a strength and a survival advantage. It increases the resiliency of the community of plants that are growing there. We have to start thinking about neurodiversity as a strength and a source of resiliency and creativity for the human community.
We're talking to author Steve Silberman about his new book on the history and future of autism. It's called Neurotribes. And you can join the conversation. Is this your story? Are you dealing with autism in your daily life for you or someone in your family? What kind of changes, what kind of accommodations could make the world an easier place to live? Parents, how has having an autistic child affected your family and your life? What do you think is the best way to think about autism, to work with the condition in the future? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking to Steve Silberman, author of Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity. He says we need to change the way we think about autism and work to make the world a friendlier, more manageable place for people with autism. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have friends or family or students on the autism spectrum, or is that you, yourself? What kind of things can help in daily routines when dealing with autism? Parents, how has autism affected your life? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to a caller. Jean is on the line in La Crosse. Jean, hi.
Hi, I'm married into a family in which there is a person who we believe is somewhere on the autism spectrum, and I found it extremely difficult to find information. Most of it was, again, as you pointed out, is based on children, and particularly for adults who were not diagnosed as, you know, having any, you know, neural specialization or neurodiversity, and for that reason, their family suffered, and there is little support for finding out how to even deal with that person, let alone maybe find some help for that person becoming a contributing member to the society. There seems to be a lot of work done in England on adults with Asperger's in particular, which is kind of what I think that we're looking at. But I applaud your efforts.
Jean, thanks a lot for that call. And Steve, part of the idea of Neurotribes is that some of those adults with autism are starting to find each other and work through these issues. Can you talk about how people with autism themselves are working to change things?
Yeah, well, one of the sort of landmark things that happened in the late 80s and early 90s was that once the diagnosis became available to adults, partly through the invention of the diagnosis of the Asperger syndrome condition in England, as Jean, the caller, just pointed out. By the way, in many ways, I think England has been ahead of us by a couple of decades, because they already knew that autistic children become autistic adults back in the 80s. And so they've been really setting up things like permanent living spaces for autistic people and supportive communities. The National Autistic Society in England devotes 2/3 of its funding to services for adults, as opposed to the NIH here, which devotes less than 2% of its research to researching adults. I do want to, by the way, mention for Gene and for other callers out there, I have a page on my website, stevesilberman.com. That's stevesilberman.com/resources. The resources are a list of books that will help people who either think they may be autistic themselves or perhaps they have a close relative who they think might be autistic. It will help them both determine if they really are autistic and also help them navigate this world that can be very difficult to navigate for a person on the spectrum. So there are a lot of helpful books listed there for Gene and for any other people who are listening. I'm sorry, what did you ask me? I sort of got distracted.
Oh, no, you were getting to it there. But adults now with autism are getting together.
Oh,
they're
yes,
becoming
yes, yes.
activists, too.
Yeah. So what happened in the, really in the 1990s, was that the Internet emerged. And it turns out that the Internet is like a very comfortable place for many people on the spectrum to talk to one another. They don't have to make sense of social signals in real time. They don't have to parse body language or tone of voice. They don't have to look in the person's eyes, which can be very distracting for a person with autism. They can take as much time as they need to compose their thoughts. Of course, as many of your listeners know, there are many autistic people who can't use spoken language at all or who periodically can't use spoken language, but get them behind a keyboard and they're rocking the house. So, in fact, I have several friends who basically can't speak, but who are incredibly articulate with a keyboard. So the Internet became a place where autistic people could share the stories of their lives with each other, and once they were able to do that, they sort of lost patience with the notion that all of their intense fascinations for things and their interest in science fiction and technology, that these were merely expressions of psychopathology. They started to value their own and each other's lives in a way outside of the kind of medical model of talking about autism as a form of illness. And so they started to build organizations like the Autism Women's Network, the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network, and other organizations that are basically run by autistic people for autistic people. And those organizations, particularly the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network, are starting to have a real impact on public policy around autism. And it's not just for their impact does not just benefit so-called high-functioning people with Asperger syndrome. I don't like to use the phrases high and low functioning for reasons I explain in the book, but anyway, they really benefit people at all points on the spectrum. Like ASAN recently convinced the Department of Transportation to issue guidelines on making commercial air travel more comfortable for people on the spectrum and their families of all ages. So anyway, the autistic people who have always been historically left out of conversations about their future are now taking a central role in determining the policies that will help them and their families.
Gene, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. As we talk to Steve Silberman, author of Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity. Steve, I want to get a little more into making the world a more approachable place for someone with autism. You give an example of, I think it was a tech company who changed their interview process, because in a face-to-face interview, I mean, that could be a nightmare or even an impossibility for some people with autism. But if presented with the right test, the right puzzle to solve, they could prove themselves as a really effective employee.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we have a very limited idea of who makes a good employee. You know, what are human resources departments looking for? They're looking for good people persons, candidates, or, you know, people who can really sell themselves in an interview. Well, those are, you know, not the traditional strengths of people on the spectrum. However, there's a company called Specialistern, which hires programmers and software debuggers who are on the spectrum for even the giant German software company SAP. And what they did was, they replaced face-to-face interviews where, you know, the interviewer basically tries to see if the person on the other side of the desk will fit in with the social culture of the office. They replaced that with allowing interview candidates to build Lego Mindstorm robots and really just show off what they can do with hands-on work. And that's the kind of skill set that comes very naturally to autistic people and draws on the natural strengths of the autistic brain. And so by widening our conception of who might make a valuable employee, depending on the task that they're committed to, we can really take advantage of the strengths of minds that have been traditionally left out of the workplace.
And one practical step, I think you mentioned some schools are doing or looking at getting to students now. People with autism maybe in a school just need a quiet room, a low sensory stimulation environment to get to when that being surrounded by other kids and faces and voices is a little too much.
Yeah, well, there are many different ways of sort of customizing the environment so that it's more comfortable for people on the spectrum. For instance, many people on the spectrum are bothered by fluorescent lights. Neurotypical people, that is, non-autistic people, you know, don't even notice. But for an autistic person, it can be, you know, the fluorescent light can be buzzing and flickering and could even trigger a seizure. And so by paying attention to the sensory needs of autistic children and allowing them to customize their own space as much as possible, and also by presenting the lessons and the curricula in forms that take advantage of their natural aptitudes, we'll be able to give a better educational experience to those children.
Very briefly, Steve, as we wrap up, is this a turning point? Do you think things are going to improve in the way the rest of society interacts with the members of society who have autism?
Well, I don't, you know, obviously I sat in my room for 5 years, 80 hours a week, writing my little book. I didn't have such grandiose aims, although my hope was that I would be able to change the conversation. The book just became a bestseller on the New York Times list. So hopefully people are reading it, and hopefully they're carrying the message into their own lives.
Steve, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Steve Silberman. We've been talking about the history, the present, and the future of autism. His new book is Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity. Here's some late breaking news from over 4,500 years ago. Stonehenge, that famous circle of standing stones in England, it's one of the best known prehistoric monuments in human history. But a new discovery changes our understanding of what the Stonehenge neighborhood originally looked like. The Stonehenge Hidden Landscape Project has been using high-tech imaging equipment to map out the area underground. They're calling the process archaeology on steroids. And they found so far, they'd found chapels, other landmarks buried in the surrounding area. And now, about a mile northwest of Stonehenge, they found the remains of another huge stone structure, at least 90 sandstone blocks, about 15 feet tall. That's feet, not inches. It may have been a ceremonial arena of some sort. It looks like later residents of the area came, knocked down the stones, and used them as the base for an earthen protective wall. So otherwise it could have still been there, I guess. So Stonehenge, not a standalone monument, but part of a vast complex. It's mind-blowing stuff, and of course there's only one song we can go out to the news with. This is Spinal Tap with Stonehenge.
Stonehenge, where the demons dwell, where the banshees live.